Madam Chief Justice and Justices of the Court, if it please the Court, my name is Steve Walsh, and I'm representing the appellant Samuel Andrew Freeman, and urging this Court to vacate and reverse the judgment and verdict of the trial court. As this Court has held on a number of occasions, each case must be considered in light of its own particular facts and circumstances, and there's never been a case like this before this Court or any court in Missouri. It is unique because the totality of the circumstances support our position. There was absolutely no motive for murder. There were no eyewitnesses putting the defendant at or near the crime scene. There were no admissions against interest by the defendant to the authorities or to the third parties. There was the absence of fingerprints or any other objective evidence placing the defendant in the crime scene, and in this case with the victim in her apartment. Instead, there was 10 trillionth of a gram of DNA matching the profile of the defendant, matching the profile of the victim, and at least one other unknown person, possibly two other unknown persons, possibly
three.
This was
in some sort of a bodily fluid that we don't know what it was?
Correct.
The state because it's such a tiny amount, they can't tell whether it's blood, semen, whatever.
He cannot tell by examining it under his lamp, or, well, of course, you can't see it in a microscope. You can't see it. He didn't know if it was semen, blood, skin cells. Just didn't know.
So are you denying that this was your client's DNA?
No. What we are saying is this, that as the state's expert said, he said DNA is minuscule, obviously. It is robust. This DNA survived 13 years in an evidence locker, and it is easily transferred, either skin to skin, skin to clothing, clothing to skin, indirectly from my skin to an object, another person touching that object. And in this case, he stated that it could be transferred earlier that evening because the victim and the defendant were together. They were regulars at a small VFW bar in Poplar Bluff.
But they didn't really touch, other than the fact that, what did he say, he might have tapped her on the shoulder?
Well, he was seated beside her.
Yeah, that was only physical contact.
Well, it's speculation like the whole case of the state. He sat beside her. He stood beside her. They were all playing pool. They were all sharing a common pool cue. They were all playing games here. He was flirting with her.
Isn't it significant that the DNA was on toilet paper that was the same as toilet paper in her apartment?
Well, that calls for the inference that this toilet paper never left that apartment. And with the other
toilet paper on her shoulder, went to the bar and came back.
Right.
So why wasn't that for the jury, though, to decide whether to draw that inference or not?
Well, because it would be speculation and conjecture that toilet paper never left the apartment. But there's unknown persons on it, too, which calls for...
Why weren't the facts sufficient that it was toilet paper from the apartment found in the apartment next to her with his DNA? Certainly the jury could have decided maybe she put it in her purse, as you argued, and so forth. But why doesn't this raise, at a minimum, the equally valid inferences, rule that we've rejected? And I know you all discuss in your briefs, but certainly... if we're going to say you have to prove every item in an apartment with someone's DNA didn't leave the apartment, you'd never make any case.
No, it was on a fixed object. That would be a stronger argument that he was present there, like a fingerprint, that shows presence. But in this case, the expert for the state stated he could not state with any certainty that the DNA was transferred at that site in that apartment.
Did you test other surfaces like the sheets or any of the other areas around the crime scene?
Mm-hmm. Other things were submitted to him and no DNA was found.
The apartment was white basically, but you found a little bit of DNA was found in
right.
Two locations.
Fingerprints were found belonging to, again, unknown persons, two Afro-American pubic hairs were found, not tested, and unknown persons also. So as their expert said, we had DNA that I determined to be foreign. There's DNA that is foreign to all the people that I tested in this case. The other expert for the state said, I found nothing to link Sam Freeman to the crime scene. The eyewitness, interestingly enough, indicated that he thought he knew, as he saw this person go into the park, he thought he knew that person and said, well, he had long, wavy hair. Of course, Sam Freeman is a career military man, of course, had a crew cut.
But his physical description was within the realms of the height and weight of Mr. Freeman.
Well, if you have a margin of error of several inches, I suppose, so. Again, he didn't see the face, but he thought he saw the dress in essence of somebody he had seen before, and it wasn't the defendant. The other, there was no weapon found. And when we say weapon, over our objection, the trial court let into evidence a Galliano bottle. Based on the testimony that he left the bar that night with an empty Galliano bottle. But the pathologist, I would say substitute pathologist, Dr. Zirkor, indicated that there was nothing linking that Galliano bottle to the crime scene or to the victim. That is, that the bruise behind her ear was some blunt object, it could be a fist, that the wounds in her vagina call for a separate conclusion because there was deep linear tears inside her vaginal vault, which could not be caused by a Galliano bottle. Interestingly enough, there was I think a stick that was actually at the crime scene, but it was not tested. Didn't know which size Galliano bottle it was. The Galliano bottle they produced was found 13 years later in the defendant's nephew's bedroom, and then they brought another smaller bottle in that, for demonstrative purposes, it somehow made it back into the jury room. The cases that have been cited by the state all have something more. That is, a fingerprint, something linking, proving the presence of the assailant at the crime scene. In the Rocket case, I believe it was, they had a fingerprint on a condom box and then his DNA in the condom. The victim had been sexually raped, sodomized. There's something more there. In this case, if, say, my son here went to a bar and flirted with a girl, maybe danced with her, and she was later found murdered, his DNA would probably appear on clothing, skin, things submitted to the lab. And that is just an example of how, if this decision is allowed to stand, the illogic in it and how it does not follow precedence. Again, we're talking about a DNA that is minuscule, 125 trillionths of a gram. It is robust, and it is easily transferred.
You leave out the part of the evidence concerning the argument, and you specifically say there was no motive.
But
there was more interaction between them, that they actually had an argument, and your client tried to buy her a drink afterwards, and she refused.
Right. She thought that my client was trying to hustle a teenager there, and they're all regulars. Okay, everybody knew everybody there. I mean, they had been going to this bar for over a year, three or four times a week. It's like the Cheers bar with the regulars there. But she thought he was trying to hustle a teenager and spoke up at him. And I believe one of the barmaids says, well, he had a disgruntled look on his face. I think it's important that when he left there, one barmaid said, his attitude was normal. The other barmaid said he was in a good mood. And, of course, the argument by the state at trial was he was in an alcohol rage. Then they argued also that he wasn't in alcohol rage. But that what I just said supports our argument that there was no motive to do what was a very vile, evil act of choking her to the point that her bone cracked in her throat, and then torture her for probably a number of hours, consuming two beers in the process. We argued this was the act of a cold, calculated serial killer, perhaps a railroad killer who was circulating at this time. This was not the act of a person like Sam Freeman, who had, you know, came in with no criminal record, no history of violence, nothing. So for these reasons, we urge the court to...
Mr. Walsh, can I ask you this?
Yes,
this
sir.
Case were just a little bit different and there was DNA that was extracted from some object at the crime scene that was completely non-portable and pointed strongly to the fact that the defendant was at that scene, and he denied being at that scene, but at the same time, that was the sole evidence, and you had no motive, no eyewitnesses, no admissions, man with no apparent bizarre personality features, whatever. Could a court of appeals say, this is just, we just can't buy this DNA testimony because it is so bizarre to believe in the science here when our common sense tells us it doesn't work? Could a court of appeals reverse a conviction on that basis?
Well, because it's so easily transferred, it probably would depend on where that occurred. I would suppose in this apartment, because conceivably she could touch something, brush something in that apartment when she came home. Although the testimony in this case was from the state that she was not rendered disabled at the threshold, and then the killer drug her into the bedroom. So that would be a stronger case if it was found on some fixed object there that she would not have had an opportunity to touch.
Was there any DNA testing following up on Judge Smart's question above the, you said that there were a couple of beers consumed during the course of this time. Was there any DNA testing done on the bottles or any of that stuff?
Yes, sir.
But
on
nothing.
The beer cans.
But nothing.
Nothing.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'd like to first respond to a couple of things that Mr. Walsh brought up. He indicated that the pathologist, as I heard him, said that the bottle was not linked to any of the injuries the victim suffered. The pathologist did not so testify. The pathologist described the injuries and how they may have occurred, but he made no direct linkage one way or the other as far as any bottle might be concerned. So that would not be the case.
How is the bottle relevant?
Well, again, the testimony was that the defendant was seen leaving with the Galliano bottle. Certainly the injuries were of such a nature that bottle could have been used to inflict them. So the jury's able to view the bottle, it's able to view the evidence of the injuries, which included some pictures as well as testimony, and make the determination whether it is, you know, reasonably likely or likely beyond a reasonable doubt that this bottle could have been used to inflict the injuries.
How could they have found that just by finding his nephew had a bottle 13 years later?
Well, again, let's be clear about this. The bottles that were brought to trial were brought as demonstrative of what a Galliano bottle looks like. The state at no point during this trial said these were the bottles that were actually used. That was made very clear. But because there was testimony that the appellant had a Galliano bottle, the jury, of course, needed to see, for those that aren't familiar with them, what did this bottle look like so they can gauge the characteristics of that type of bottle and make the determination whether that bottle could have caused the injuries that the victim suffered.
You're saying that's something that's within the province of a layperson?
Yes, I believe aided by the expert testimony that the pathologist gave them at trial, those are things that certainly as the kind of determination juries are asked to make all the time, as to, you know, when a particular, you have an object that you can't say absolutely was used because nobody saw it, but you can say, does the characteristics of the injuries and the characteristics of this particular object match up? And juries make that kind of determination all the time. Another thing that Mr. Walsh indicated was that this, I guess for lack of a better term, sodomization occurred over several hours. That's actually not what the evidence showed. There was no testimony to that effect, and it seems that actually she could have been strangled within a 3 to 5 minute period is what the pathologist testified to. So it's not necessarily followed that it lasted over several hours. It could have
been
much more.
Did the pathologist indicate that the brutalization of the victim took place at or close to the time of death?
Either at the same time or just before, and I think that was based on the characteristics of the blood and how they determine whether a person is still alive or not. And I believe the strangulation itself, he said, could take between 3 and 5 minutes. So not necessarily a case that this would have been going on for hours and hours.
The murder took place in 92. Why did the DNA testing take place in 2005?
Well, I don't think the technology existed in 92, as best I can tell.
Because this required a more sophisticated than usual level of DNA testing, is that? Because we certainly had DNA testing then.
Perhaps. That wasn't really fully fleshed out at trial, to be honest, and I'm not going to stand here and claim the scientific expertise to say exactly what testing was available and why or why not it could be done. But
or what prompted the investigation being opened up at that point?
Yeah, that's not entirely clear from the record. I think at some point it was apparently determined that there were some items that could be subjected to that testing. The DNA testing was done. The samples originally were put into the CODIS system and didn't bring back any matches at that time. And later on, again, I'm not sure what exactly prompted them to come up with the appellant's DNA sample, which was not in that system, but they did that and were able to get the match.
Well, there was testimony by Mr. Wyckoff that DNA degrades over time.
Correct.
Was there an explanation of why this DNA had not degraded or why he was still able to detect it?
I don't know if it was quite that specific. I think in general terms, the degradation has a lot to do with the circumstances under which it's kept. Now, of course, this has been kept in sealed evidence bags, and I would imagine that would slow down any degradation. And I don't know what we can say for sure that it did not degrade to some extent over that period of time, but just had not fully degraded. So the you know, certainly the atmosphere, talking about atmospheric type conditions, perhaps the type of substance that it's on, the fact perhaps that it's a bodily fluid, contains the DNA as opposed to a drier sample like a skin cell that's more likely to flake off and degrade. All of those kinds of things can play into that.
Did Mr. Wyckoff bring to trial any exhibits that showed the DNA characteristics or things to show the jury? Is the jury just taking his word for this? I mean, you know, with a fingerprint, they have the blow up of the fingerprint and stuff.
I don't recall any visuals of like a double helix or anything like that. To be honest, I don't remember scanning through to look for something like that. But certainly he testified at length about the characteristics of DNA, a proper subject for expert testimony, and none of that's been challenged. Certainly the defendant had ample opportunity on cross-examination to question him about those areas, and he did. If he were just satisfied with Mr. Wyckoff's testimony, he certainly had the ability to bring in an expert of his own to challenge it further in that regard. So,
isn't that kind of out of the reach of a lot of defendants? Of course, they could apply, I guess, to the court for funds for that.
Well, of course, this was a non-indigent defendant who had counsel, so I haven't heard any suggestion that there was any inability to pay. I'm certainly not going to stand here and make the assumption that he couldn't do it if that were necessary. But really, the validity, overall validity of the DNA testing has not been, to my knowledge, just directly challenged. What we're getting here is what conclusions can be drawn from that evidence. And really, this is just a very basic situation of where the defense has one scenario that they draw, the state has another. Those are presented to the jury at trial. The jury made its decision as to what scenario was the most reasonable and most likely from the evidence, but the defendant standing up here saying, you should believe our version instead of the version that the jury believed.
Do we have another case where, as I get it here, the evidence is there was a fight at a bar?
Yes.
The victim is killed at the house. There's very little evidence other than some toilet paper with some DNA that was tested a number of years later. That's our evidence.
As well as the stocking that was used to strangle her that also had the appellant's DNA on it, which is pretty probative evidence, I would submit.
Do we have any other cases that rest on that quantity of evidence?
I don't know that the other cases I've read have specifically dealt with that particular, you know, I mean, there was the case out of the Western District that I cited in the brief, and the name of it, it started with Calhoun, which I think dealt with a fairly small amount of DNA.
Fingerprint on the bullets.
Fingerprints on the bullets, a thumbprint, I think that was Grimm, the thumbprint on the the purse or something connected with the purse. I don't remember what the item was. Yeah, I mean, there are obviously a lot of cases where the physical evidence maybe doesn't seem to be great in quantity, but due to the nature of it, where it's located, things like that, it certainly has probative value. And as far as the amount of the DNA sample that was left, you know, I would certainly say it was certainly enough to get some very good samples for testing. I think it's very easy for us, particularly as lay people, to look at those numbers and just think, well, how can that possibly be enough? But I think, you know, from the scientific standpoint, that's plenty for their purposes. So I caution against, you know, maybe reading too much into that. But it's the reliability of the test sample that they're able to get, really, that should be the most important factor. And if there is enough for that, then that does provide sufficient evidence for the jury to reach the verdict that it does.
What about the fact that there was DNA of an additional person?
Well, that goes to the weight of the evidence. I mean, the truth is you're often going to get mixtures of DNA. That's not an uncommon thing. It'd be nice to have things as neat and clean as here's the defendant, here's the victim, and nobody else exists, but that isn't always going to be the case. And what appellant's argument on that really does is put us back into the position of the equally valid inference rule, which is we've got to disprove any possible hypothesis of innocence, which is, of course, not the standard. The standard is whether there was enough evidence taken in the light most favorable to the state, the jury could reach the decision that it did. And in this case, the fact that the appellant's DNA is on the instrument used in her murder, that stocking, as well as a piece of toilet paper that's found directly under her shoulder as her body's lying on the bed, is very probative evidence. And when you combine it with all the other things, the fact that they did have an argument, even though motive is not something we have to prove, there's at least a potential motive. You have this possession of a bottle that could have been used to inflict other injuries that this victim suffered. You have some eyewitness testimony.
Can you discuss how the eyewitness's testimony seemed to vary from time to time? Is it
right?
Can you comment on that briefly?
Sure.
I won't take too much
sure.
time for that.
But. He made two statements, one to the police shortly after this murder occurred, in which he gave a fairly general description of the person he saw, height and weight, I think some general clothing descriptions, that would generally match the defendant's height and weight and the clothing he was wearing at that time. At the trial, some 13 or however many years later.
Well, and there was another statement in 94?
Is that right?
Were there essentially three statements, three pretrial statements?
Well, Your Honor,
Am I mistaken?
I don't specifically, you might be right, I don't specifically remember the middle statement. What I basically remember was the difference between what he told police originally and what he testified to at trial after talking to the defense counsel, which became not only a lot more detailed, but I think the prosecution cross-examination showed why the amount of detail he gave for the opportunity he had to see this person at night was very questionable. And the jury, of course, has the opportunity to believe any of the statements he gave or none of them, and we don't know for certain, of course, never do exactly how much credibility they attach.
Well, but is it fair to say there was no one who saw this defendant go in the apartment, or do you disagree with that?
No one else that we know of. To our knowledge...
No, I mean no one. Did Mr. Nichols see this defendant go in the apartment?
If you're asking... If you're asking, did he make a positive identification of, I saw Samuel Freeman go in that apartment, no, he did not. He gave a description of a person he saw follow the victim into the apartment, and that description generally fits...
Well, the Southern District relegated that to a footnote. So they thought it was pretty much out of the question that this eyewitness had any... had anything to bring to the table.
Well, that's probably one of several areas where I would have some difficulty with the Southern District's opinion, in all honesty, Your Honor. We think it's certainly evidence the jury could have used, in addition to all the other evidence, to reach the verdict that it did.
Your opponent says that DNA is robust, and yet you say that your expert testifies just the opposite.
Not necessarily the opposite. I just think I think defense counsel is overstating the testimony. Under certain circumstances, it can last for a long time. But like other biological materials, it does degrade over time. So just to say it's naturally robust, that it will inevitably be robust, I think would be to say too much. Just as it would be too much to say that it inevitably will transfer every time somebody has some contact, because as the expert said, yes, it does transfer, and it can transfer in a number of ways, but it does not always transfer.
So your explanation that it can be degradable is an explanation on why maybe DNA wasn't found on other surfaces?
It could be one. It could be the fact that maybe there was some wipe down going on after the murder that would have eliminated some of it. It could be that the defendant didn't touch some of these things. There are all kinds of possibilities we can get into the realm of, but again, that goes back to the question of, does the state have to disprove every possible hypothesis here in order for this conviction to stand? That not being the standard, does the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict support that verdict? And it's our contention that it does. And unless there are any other questions, we'd ask that the conviction and sentence be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you a question. It seems to me that the evidence here is there's a fight at a bar. There is DNA at the scene that links your client to the person who was killed. And there's kind of vague testimony of similarity of appearance. Now, that may not be the strongest evidence in the world, but isn't that really what a jury's for?
Well, if I may disagree I'm
asking you to disagree with me and tell me why. That's not just barely enough to get to the jury, and the jury decided.
No witness said there was a fight. There were words that she spoke to the defendant. She thought he was taking advantage of a teenager playing pool, and it lasted a matter of a few seconds. And I think one witness said, "Well, this is what you see in a bar. Nobody thought anything of it." And again, he went up to her afterwards and flirted with her, offered to buy her a drink, left in either a good mood or a normal mood. This was a vile, awful tragedy that took place, and it does not conform with the facts we have here. The forensic crime scene examiner, Donwell Clark, who's a veteran of Poplar Bluff, he indicated that, in his opinion, the killer manipulated the body and drank two beers while he did it. He left a partial fingerprint, but they couldn't lift that. Found a fingerprint on the shower head, found a partial fingerprint on the headboard. I don't believe there's no report of cases where you have these mixtures of DNA where you have, again, at the crime scene, not only on every piece of evidence submitted, and important in this case, the DNA of the victim, the defendant, and then up to three other people. And we did not challenge the DNA because it was inconclusive, and it supported our theory that the DNA was probably transferred at this bar. The expert said, I don't know when it attached. It could have attached days earlier. I don't know how it attached. And he could not state with any degree of certainty that, yes, it was transferred there at the crime scene. Going back to the...
And the DNA was taken from some material that was exterior to her body? There wasn't anything in her vagina or any...
Correct. It was from a tissue and from the ligature and from her other stocking. And back to the bottle over our... The state tried to introduce the Galliano bottle with the pathologist, but the trial court denied that the request because, again, there was nothing to link this Galliano bottle to this crime scene. But at closing argument, prosecutors love to have something in their hands, and the prosecutor, the assistant attorney general, argued with this full of liquid, which was not the case when he left the bar, this Galliano bottle, saying this is a torture weapon to inflame the jury. Again, based on the fact that we just have DNA on portable items that has other unknown profiles, we would urge the court to reverse the verdict and judgment.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.